Hi everyone, and welcome again to the first Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast of 2014, and a warm welcome back to my co-host, Andrew Nixon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
There's a big show here. The World Cup qualifiers are starting in a couple of days, and it's been a lot of news over the break, slow through, to talk about, as well as the Asian Cup Under-19 tournament. But, so let's start with that. It was an interesting tournament, Andrew. A little bit disappointing for the Associates, except Afghanistan, who did extraordinarily well.
Yes, Afghanistan's performance was quite superb. They beat Sri Lanka in the first round. Most people expected that they would perhaps beat Bangladesh, but they ended up beating Sri Lanka instead. Got to the semi-finals, and so they didn't disgrace themselves against Pakistan in that semi-final, only losing by 2 wickets. Taking it almost to the final over of the match, and a quite superb performance from Afghanistan. It's good to see.
Any standout players you think are going to come through from that you saw?
The whole team really seemed to perform well. There was some good batting performances, some good bowling performances. It's hard to single out any particular individual players, but hopefully Afghanistan can keep this team together ahead of the Under-19 World Cup in a few months' time. And perhaps cause some upsets there as well. They've been quite an easy group to some extent. They've got another associate plus Bangladesh in their first round group in that tournament. So we could see them progressing in that tournament as well, making the quarterfinals, and who knows where they go from there.
Yeah, and obviously bodes really well for their future that they're developing such a strong youth base as well as having such a strong senior team.
Yeah, absolutely. I know the age group teams below that have struggled. Their under-16 team are in the second division in the Asian tournaments, but the under-19 team obviously doing as well as the senior team seems to be doing. And yeah, it bodes very well for the future. And if they can get that under-16 team sorted out as well and carry on this, what looks like a good production line of talent.
With the other teams, Nepal was probably the best of them, but they struggled a bit against the full members. Malaysia was particularly weak, unfortunately.
Yeah, Malaysia were remarkably poor. They made, you look at the scores, they made 50 against Bangladesh, and they made even less against Sri Lanka, they made 32, and then even against Afghanistan, they could only manage 40. So a very poor tournament for Malaysia, and they'll sort of go home and try to pick themselves up and work out what's gone wrong, and it was the batting, the bowling for Malaysia wasn't too bad. It wasn't brilliant, but you know, it's hard to really look at the bowling when they're chasing such low scores. But from what I've heard, the bowlers are actually sort of put things in the right areas and actually bowled reasonably well despite defending low scores. And it's a shame for Malaysia, but you know, there's always got to be a weak side, and perhaps you know there is a possibility that maybe 18 is too many. Maybe having 4 associates in is too many. Maybe having just 2 qualify might be better at this sort of level. But we'll see. But I'm sure Malaysia will come back and try and do better next time.
Yeah, the tournament that's been ongoing, but it's still in the middle of it at the moment. The East Asia Pacific representative side, sans any players from PNG who are obviously busy preparing for the World Cup qualifiers, has been playing in the Australian Country Championships. East Asia Pacific had been doing quite badly in the 2-day games. They were lost outright in the first against South Australia, but managed to tie Queensland in this 1-day. So a bit of mixed bag results.
The tie against Queensland was quite a superb performance. Jason Keeler, one of the Papua New Guinea players who actually is in the side, scoring 101 from 72 balls, which is a superb batting performance. And even the tie, it's not often you see a tie in one-day cricket, but Matu Tava from Vanuatu bowled well for them, taking 3 wickets, and some promising signs there.
We've had some other documents come in over the Christmas break, which has been interesting to read through. One of them was the ICC's report on whether or not it should become an Olympic sport. It seemed to be predetermined perhaps a little that it wouldn't be in Narcisse's best interest for that to happen? Is that your reading of what was prepared?
Yeah, that would certainly be my reading. It's something of a cop-out to some extent. I think it's trying to meet a conclusion that was already decided. And, you know, you read through it and you notice that all the benefits of being in the Olympics apply to associate cricket and associate and affiliate cricket and to women's cricket to some extent, and then all the negatives of it apply to the full members. And if the negatives apply to the full members, then it probably isn't going to happen. The negative things, I think, can be overcome. Some of them are, I think, a little overstated. The ECB apparently say that, you know, the Olympics would mean they'd have to lose 4 test matches out of their summer, and it would cost them $130 million, which I think is nonsense. You know, the Olympics last 2 weeks. I don't see how you get 4 test matches in 2 weeks. If you're clever with a format, use 2 grounds, play matches simultaneously, you can easily get a 12-team tournament done in a little over a week. So you're losing 1 test match, really. And of course, you know, just last year, the ECB managed to host 7 test matches in a summer where they had a 3-week ICC tournament. So quite how a 2-week tournament can take 4 test matches out of a season and a 2-week Olympic tournament does is a puzzle to me, but the ECB seem to have a different way of looking at the world than me. And you look at some of the other things, teams aren't allowed sponsors on their shirts. Well, they're not allowed sponsors on their shirts in ICC tournaments either, unless they're the proper ICC-approved sponsors. So, there's the issues of countries not matching with the ICC and then the IOC. Other sports have this problem as well, and they all find ways of overcoming it, and I don't think cricket would be necessarily any different. So, there's lots of problems which can be overcome, and there's a lot of benefits. And I think the benefits, in general, far outweigh the drawbacks of participating in the Olympics, not least the fact that some countries will see the money going into cricket increase, you know, many, many times over. I've heard of some countries that currently only get $10,000 ICC funding would all of a sudden be getting, you know, 6-figure sums from their governments, possibly even over $1 million from their governments for a sport that participates in the Olympics. Yes, these teams probably aren't going to make the Olympics, but being in the Olympics gets you more recognition from your government than not being in the Olympics. And perhaps, I mean, as many people know, I'm quite the cynic, and when these countries are getting nearly all their money from the ICC, they're not going to kick up a fuss when the ICC do things that they disagree with. All of a sudden, if they're getting most of their money from not the ICC, then, well, maybe they feel a bit more confident in kicking up a fuss. Maybe they feel a bit more confident in voting against ICC things and bringing perhaps legal cases against the ICC. And, you know, the cynical part of me thinks that's the real reason the ICC don't want cricket in the Olympics, because they'll lose an element of control.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. A lot of the countries that do benefit are the nations that are very popular in the Olympics, prominent in the Olympics, the European nations in particular. And so there was a sense in the report that, well, a lot of the nations in the cricket aren't part of that group that they care about, their Asian nations, and that they don't go into the Olympics, which kind of ignored the fact that actually one of the reasons the IOC is interested in having cricket in the Olympics is because it's a popular sport in the Indian subcontinent, and the Olympics doesn't do particularly well there, and there is a synergy that could be exploited that cricket isn't taken advantage of just because they want to keep control of things. It also mentioned, obviously, the World 2020 would crash and they would not be able to run the World 2020, but actually, at the time the report was produced, they had 2 World 2020s and now they only have 1, so they've actually, that was a moot point anyway. They've actually already given up the money the ICC was going to get from that second World 2020, so it's a strange little report. It didn't add up the benefits. It's kind of glossed over that they would be potentially up to $1 million, but we're not going to add up how many countries this would apply to. But we're going to emphasize that there's a huge losses for a couple of our members potentially, even though they seem wildly exaggerated. The other thing I'd add on this, and it's one thing that's going to become more prominent, is that the Olympic movement itself is expanding its sense of operations. We've already seen this with the Asian Games, which will be held in Incheon at the end of the year, which has cricket within it, and they've introduced, I think there's a European Games that are starting in 2015 or 16, I think it's in Azerbaijan. So even though it's quite difficult to get an Olympic sport in, it's not necessarily going to be more difficult to get an Olympic regional competition, and that itself would be a particularly benefit for nations within that region, and we've seen that with the Asian Games already, and I'm sure we'd see that if cricket made a push for regional inclusion in say, the European Games or South American Games or African Games and those types of competitions. So it doesn't need to be an either or, let's just go for the Olympics thing either. There's actually quite a lot of aspects to the Olympic movement that could be explored and aren't being explored just because they outright reject any sort of involvement for their own to keep control of what's going on in cricket.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I know there was a push to get cricket into the Pan American Games, which are going to be held in Toronto, I think, next year, but that didn't succeed. But it's sort of on the sort of back burner that it might happen in future in the Pan American Games. And, you know, it's in the Pacific Games, of course, and there's all sorts of opportunities there for cricket to get noticed and to improve the cricket infrastructure in countries. You know, if you host the Olympics, of course, you have to build the venues. There's a bit of debate in any country that hosts the Olympics. There's a bit of debate about the legacy of those venues. Some venues end up being mothballed. That's sort of unavoidable. It's always going to happen. But you see in South Korea, who are hosting the Asian Games this year, are building a very good cricket ground, and if that can stay in the future and be used by South Korea, then that's, you know, superb for South Korea, and other countries could very well see the benefits of that. If your cricket was in the next Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, then Rio would be building cricket grounds, and there's that legacy effect that the Olympics can have in a country that I don't think the report necessarily addresses.
Speaking of smaller games, there was a meeting recently that raised the possibility that the cricket would be in the 2017 Commonwealth Youth Games.
Yeah, and you know, some of the worries that the ICC had don't necessarily apply to the Commonwealth Games. One of them was that, you know, England and Scotland compete separately in cricket, but they combine in the UK team, the Olympics. That doesn't apply to the Commonwealth Games. And hopefully cricket can be included, and a lot of the problems don't apply. You're dealing with under-19 athletes, so a lot of the worries about clashing with seasons and stuff don't necessarily apply as much as they do for the senior teams, and it'll be a sort of positive if cricket can get in the Commonwealth Youth Games and then maybe get back into the Commonwealth Games. It was in the 1998 Commonwealth Games in Kuala Lumpur, and if we can get back in there, and that's another kick to get cricket into eventually the Olympics.
Yeah, and obviously, again, that has that legacy effect. Malaysia is hosting World Cricket League Division 4, and I assume they're using some of the grounds that were used in the Commonwealth Games. So moving on then, there was some news coming out of the Development Committee. It wasn't published, of course, but we have our sources, some of which was quite interesting and potentially worrying, and some is actually quite positive. We'll go through bits of it one by one. Firstly, the ODI T20 status for the teams in the World Cup qualifiers is still under review, and we don't know what's going to happen there.
No, you'd have hoped that with the tournament starting in just a few days that these decisions would have been made already. I think the teams are going under the assumption that it will continue to be six teams with ODI status. So Ireland, Afghanistan, plus the top four from this event. But from what we hear, that 2020 international status is also under review, that perhaps some teams may get 2020 international status but not ODI status. So that's sort of a positive, as much as I dislike the notion of status. If more teams are having the status that is there, then that's a good thing. But it's a shame that the teams are going into this tournament, this upcoming World Cup qualifier, not knowing what the outcome will be based on their position.
Yeah, I mean, that comes down as well to how the tournaments are going to be structured next year as well, and how many teams will be playing potentially in whatever they do in the iCup. I think probably every team pretty much has to make the assumption that they need to finish as high as they possibly can, just in case the cutoff is not where it was before or where they hope it might be.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
News also about the 2019 World Cup qualification. Again, nothing's been decided. I suppose they haven't really started it yet. At least it's something. But possibly the top two associates might be eligible for direct qualification because they're part of the rankings, but it seems unlikely, and it's most likely that the associates won't be able to qualify directly.
Yeah, I think at the moment the decision is that only full members can qualify directly from the rankings. There's still a lot of campaigning going on for associates to be able to qualify from the rankings, but there also apparently seems to be a worry that associates might not even be able to qualify for the rankings in the first place, which seems very odd and unfair. There was some hope that Ireland and Afghanistan would get a lot more regular ODIs against the 10 full members, but that doesn't seem to be... a case in a sort of formal, organised structure sort of way, and that doesn't seem to be happening anymore. And it's unsurprising that they talked about having full members only being able to qualify from the rankings, because they want to try and protect the full members as much as possible. Everybody knows that if the ICC got their way, there would only be the 10 full members in the World Cup, and so they don't want to put full members at risk of having a less chance of qualifying for that World Cup. They want to give the full members the maximum opportunity to qualify for the World Cup. So I can't see them letting associates qualify directly through the rankings. Associates will always have to play in a World Cup qualifier.
Yeah, there had been mooted this idea that potentially there might be some sort of league structure that teams would be relegated out of, and therefore the associates could get into the league and the top part of the league would be the part that qualified. But that's very difficult to organise in the way cricket's structured in the touring, and it seems very unlikely that would happen.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said that bringing in full members to the World Cricket League structure would be just what one-day international cricket needs. And if all one-day international cricket was in a sort of World Cricket League type structure, I would be more than happy. I would be delighted if that was the case. Unfortunately, I don't think the full members would like that. They would see it as something to potentially lose their money.
With the rankings, I know the ICC has put out a report saying that the rankings are suitable for qualification purposes, but my reading of it and my mathematical reading of it is that that's not the case at all, that they're... If you're playing teams that are mostly poorly ranked or that are lower ranked and therefore and winning most of your games, and particularly Ireland is a good example of this, then you can end up ranked well above a team that would otherwise be better than you because it's playing better teams just because of the way the ranking system is constructed. It's not a very good ranking system, and I think potentially they might be realising that when it comes to having the teams ranked at the moment where particularly in the T20 rankings, where some of the associates are ranked well above where you might think they should be based on playing those small teams.
Yeah, and we should, of course, point out that the report into whether the rankings were suitable for qualification was done by David Kendix, who designed the ranking system in the first place. So he was hardly likely to conclude that his ranking system was rubbish. It's a typical ICC report.
There was potentially some good news. More money for teams that get promoted out of World Cricket League Division 6, 5 and 4, that just because obviously they need to then travel and prepare for another tournament on top of it.
Yeah, and then having to play two tournaments within a year, and sometimes if you go through all three, you can be playing three, even four tournaments within 18 months, and getting players time off work becomes an issue. You might have to start compensating them for taking unpaid leave from work. And so, yeah, this is a big boost.
And also, more money. This is something we've been strong supporters of. The increase in broadcasting of developmental events seems to be continuing. That ICC seems to decide that it's a good thing, and there's going to be an extra $100,000 put into that.
Again, positively, live streaming has, for the most part, been a good job, and the live streaming, as we've discussed in the previous episode, does a better job at covering associate tournaments than the regular ESPN Star Sports crew does at covering associate events. So, long may live streaming of associate events continue.
And lastly, more money for umpires, which is, again, very good thing.
Training more umpires is certainly needed in associate cricket. There's been controversies about lower ranked development tournaments about the quality of some of the umpires, so more investment there is certainly a good thing. And I think what I'd like to see as well is a clear pathway for umpires from associate countries to progress. Currently the pathway, well, there isn't one from the associate and affiliate umpires family. So Paul Baldwin, who was an umpire who was based in Germany, although English by birth, he was based in Germany. He was on the associate and affiliate umpire panel, was umpiring ODIs, umpiring World Cup qualifiers, umpiring women's ODIs as well, and I Cup matches. And the pathway for him was to quit the associate and affiliate panel and start from the bottom in England umpiring second 11 cricket. And that's not really a pathway. That's going backwards in my eyes. And I think there needs to be more of a pathway from that associate affiliate panel onto the international panel rather than having to go to domestic cricket in a full member country.
Yeah, I think that's particularly the case given the troubles they have on the full panel trying to find and retain umpires. The more they can find and the broader the net they cast for umpires, the better off they'll be.
Yeah, and if you talk to, as I have in the past, to umpires in associate members, they'll tell you that they can do a much better job than the umpires from full member countries. But then all umpires think they can do better jobs than the umpires on TV.
We have heard rumours for quite a while now about teams being suspended for membership. I think we thought there might be six that were facing it. We know one of them potentially facing it now in Europe is Estonia for not having enough senior teams.
Yeah, it's a shame for Estonia. Estonia are one of the countries that have done quite well in Europe at producing more homegrown players. Some of the sort of Eastern European teams have come in and have done much better than the Western European teams at producing these homegrown players, and Estonia are one of them. So it's disappointing to see them facing suspension. They've already been removed from tournaments and now facing suspension from the ICC. And again, you get into that trap of, as we heard about Tonga last year, who are suspended, that the ICC don't actually offer support once you're suspended. You just have to fix it on your own. So it becomes a bit of a vicious circle that you need the ICC support to be able to get back in the ICC, but the ICC don't want to give you any support because you're suspended. And we could very well see in a, if you're suspended in 2014, it could be, expelled the next year, and it'll be very disappointing for cricket in Estonia.
Yeah, particularly they've also got quite a prominent women's program in Estonia as well, which is unusual in nations of that size, so that would be particularly disappointing.
And it's only 2 years ago that they were actually hosting ICC Europe Division 3 on that very wonderful ground with the kart racing track around it.
There was also some good news, something we've actually been advocating here, for potentially more bilateral regional cricket at 50 overs as well.
yeah, 50 over cricket has become a very rare beast at a regional level outside of Asia. You look at Papua New Guinea, haven't played a 50 over international since 2009. 2011, I should say. So you see how rare 50 over cricket can be in some regions, and yes, definitely a positive. You're one of the first of these multilateral events it is, really, but Italy, Guernsey, Jersey and Denmark will be playing a 50 over tournament in England at some point this year as preparation for WCL4, and these events, bilateral events, I think need to happen more, especially as not just amongst the top ranked regional teams, amongst the lower ranked regional teams that aren't playing in the 2020 events.
Obviously, with the World 2020 going to a 4-year cycle after the next tournament, not the one in Bangladesh, but the following one, there'll be a need to change the way the qualification structure works, as well as the length of time that teams are playing. And obviously, if it's only a 4-year event, teams potentially might only play one tournament every 4 years if they get any tournaments at all. So there's going to be a review of that going forward?
Yeah, and hopefully they won't just take this as an opportunity to go to even more tournaments. They can perhaps use it as an opportunity to bring in more regional 50-over competition, official regional 50-over competition, rather than just concentrating on 2020. As I think we discussed in a previous episode, you're seeing the Asian teams who do still play 50-over cricket regionally doing better in the World Cricket League, so the other region needs to bring in some 50-over cricket as well. And if the World 2020 is going to 4 years, a possible benefit of that is more 50-over cricket on a regional basis.
Yeah, I personally like to see a lot more kind of regional events that include the high-profile associates and potentially the full members if they're around. Within that structure, because if there's a 4-year gap, then you've got enough time to organise something that acts as, in the same sense that the European Championships do for football in between the World Cup, that acts as a regional tournament?
European tournament featuring England along the lines of Rugby Union Six Nations, perhaps, or America's tournament with the West Indies, Canada and the USA, Australia, New Zealand and Papua New Guinea in the Pacific, and so on and so forth. These would all be positive moves, and if they'll need some support from the ICC, and hopefully they can get it.
Speaking of some sort of support, the nations who organise tournaments themselves are now able to call themselves their nation of name, not an 11 of that nation?
Yeah, this it seems rather a little thing to some people who aren't aware of the sort of intricacies of this, but there's history in some countries of the sponsor will say, well, I don't sponsor such and such 11, I sponsor the national team, so I'm not going to give you any money to take part in this match or this tournament. And there's certainly, I know the rules in the UK are this, but they may be in other countries as well, where people who are still at school are allowed to actually miss school and miss exams to take part in an international sporting event, but aren't allowed to do that if it's just a sort of sub-representative level, as say Scotland 11 would be, as opposed to Scotland, for example. And this can have some very positive moves. Although it seems like a very little thing, it can have a big positive for getting more sponsorship, more government funding, players getting more time off work and off school and so on and so forth.
Yeah, no, I think it's something that, again, we've talked about before, that the ICC could do more to support a lot of these smaller regional tournaments, rather than trying to control everything at a full regional level. They have a lot of smaller tournaments, and giving support, even this was a small part of it, but it could potentially lead to the ICC even sanctioning those tournaments or giving some umpiring support or those types of things if it's slightly more official. I do hope that the nations involved in these also keep in mind the ICC requirements around player eligibility, and so that these are actually national 11s and not expat 11s with the national team name, which is potentially an issue if it's not ICC sanctioned.
Yeah, and there is in those development committee notes, as I mentioned, that if teams agree they can not play under ICC eligibility rules, and I'd rather that wasn't there. I'd rather them have to stick to ICC eligibility rules. But to some extent, if it's a non-ICC event, how can you have the ICC eligibility rules? But hopefully they can try and meet the ICC eligibility rules. Some bilateral events have in the past had even stricter rules than the ICC eligibility rules. The Sedara Cup between Malaysia and Singapore can only represent Malaysia and Singapore in that if you have a Malaysian or Singaporean passport. You can't just be a resident, be eligible on residence. And so there are cases of teams actually having stricter eligibility rules for these non-ICC events. Perhaps that would help work as a developmental system as well, having some stricter eligibility rules that you're forced to pick more locally produced players, homegrown players, than you otherwise would be in an ICC event. Perhaps that could be a good thing for the future as well.
Yeah, no. Zurich had a point I made a second ago. It'd be good if the ICC took a little bit more interest in these events. So even if they're not actually ICC events, they can still sanction them or say, well, we'll call this an actual ICC thing and we'll list your results on the ICC website and in our official results if they actually exist. If you follow our rules, but if you don't, then it's not. Which would be sufficient, I think, to get teams to kind of toe the line.
Yeah, and there's other things as well. You can say we'll supply you with a set of balls for use in the tournament if you follow these rules, or we'll give you some of our regional panel umpires to umpire the tournament if you fit the rules. I know that's the case in some of the European sort of sub-regional tournaments that the ICC Europe do get involved to some extent, and they'll say if you try and follow ICC eligibility rules, we'll give you a box of cricket balls to use in the tournament. We'll give you a couple of the umpires from other countries to use in the tournament to cover their expenses, and that is a possibility.
We've also learnt that Singapore will be hosting World Cricket League Division 4, which is only across the border from where World Cricket League Division 5 will be held, but they have the best infrastructure, I guess, of the nations involved.
It's becoming a little bit worrying how every World Cricket League tournament seems to be drifting towards Asia now, and I know Guernsey and Jersey were both hoping to be able to host WCL Division 4. I know they're currently in Division 5, but they were quite confident of being promoted from there. And hosting it even if their team isn't taking part as well, from what I've heard as well. So, and it's become a bit of a running joke that Malaysia, every time they play in a World Cricket League tournament, it seems to either be in Malaysia or Singapore. So, of course, they end up doing quite well. So, that's a little disappointed that there isn't more World Cricket League tournaments taking place outside of Asia, but some of these countries do have some very good infrastructure, and it's hardly unsurprising.
Yeah, it's a sign that the ICC is not doing enough to develop the infrastructure of some of its members in that kind of mid-tier, that they can't host tournaments in very many of the countries in the World Cricket League because of a lack of turf pitches and decent grounds.
You look at the other regions and the teams that tend to have the good infrastructure are the ODI status teams, so they're not going to be in the lower reaches of the World Cricket League, and you've only really got Bermuda, Namibia outside of those ODI status teams with a decent infrastructure that could host tournaments, Argentina as well to some extent.
We've also been getting some good news for Ireland and Afghanistan. They're taking advantage of their status within the associate world have been a little bit better than those around them and have already qualified for the World Cup by organising a number of fixtures. We talked about Ireland last time. The Ireland universities will be having a tournament with Scotland and England, which will be quite promising. The English universities are obviously quite strong.
Yeah, although it's actually going to be against Oxford University rather than the full British university side. So not as strong as it otherwise would be. Irish universities will still be able to call on the services of George Dockrell, who still is studying in Ireland and amongst his various other commitments. His degree seems to be lasting for a long time. He is still young, of course, so it's not surprising that he's still at university. And universities sport is something that's sometimes overlooked as a feeder for international competition, but it's something that's very important. It's something that they do very well in North America, of course, and hopefully cricket can do the same, and you can perhaps see university tournaments cropping up around the world. It'll be a very positive event, and it comes onto something we were talking earlier. There is a World University Games on the lines of the Olympic Games, and perhaps cricket, that's another opportunity for cricket to look at.
And on the Afghanistan side, they've been included in the Asia Cup, which had been mooted a little bit by Shara Khan when we talked to him last year, that perhaps they might be able to generate just enough money to get in there, and they've been included as a 15, which is great news for them.
Yeah, very good news. It sort of came out that it was the BCCI, no surprise, were most against Afghanistan being included. I think they've managed to convince them that Afghanistan can bring some money to the tournament. There is obviously a big cricket following in Afghanistan, and perhaps a good showing from Afghanistan with the TV rights for the Asia Cup and the future of the Asia Cup up for grabs. A good showing will lead to perhaps the tournament being expanded back to six teams as it was in 2004 and 2008. Afghanistan's inclusion not without some controversy. Of course, the traditional qualifier for the Asia Cup was always the ACC Trophy, and the last time that was played, Afghanistan actually finished third behind UAE and Nepal. So the Nepal fans are predictably very angry about Afghanistan playing, but Afghanistan have showed over the few years their talent on a more consistent basis than the other Asian associates have.
Unfortunately, friends, Afghanistan, their tour to Zimbabwe, which they were in fact funding, despite the fact that they get a tenth of the funding of Zimbabwe, won't be going ahead because Zimbabwe has no money.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me either. you have to wonder where all the money that the ICC are pouring into Zimbabwe is going. They got some tap funding as well, just like the associates did. They get $10 million plus a year from the ICC. And I think I read the other day that by the time the World 2020 comes around, Zimbabwe won't have played any international cricket for 6 months. Whereas, Ireland and Afghanistan are going around the world organising matches, playing loads of tournaments, and Zimbabwe just seem to be sitting at home. I know there's problems there, but you have to wonder just how much longer Zimbabwe can continue to get ICC support. It's becoming beyond a joke now. And I've always said, if you give Ireland the same level of support that Zimbabwe have had over the last, say, 6 or 7 years, you give that support to Ireland for 6 or 7 years, you'll get a much better, much stronger test-playing nation out of it than you would with Zimbabwe. You'd probably turn Ireland into one of the top six ranked teams in the world with that level of support.
I'm probably dubious of that last statement, but I certainly think that Zimbabwe as a full member, the point of being a full member is that you should have certain obligations to do certain things, the same as an associate member has certain obligations, and one of those obligations is to play test cricket, and one is to organise international tours, and if they're unable to do that, then they're unable to meet their obligations as a full member, and therefore that funding or whatever it is not really doing anything. It's going somewhere. I suspect a lot of it is actually going just to debt repayment because they're so mired in debt. And it's hard to tell. They're one of those nations that doesn't publish their accounts, certainly not publicly. So it's a bit of a mystery.
In many ways, it's like the US in associate cricket, that they just seem to be throwing good money after bad.
On the plus side, for Afghanistan, it's reported on Twitter yesterday that they are in line to play another one-day international against Pakistan in three 2020 games.
Superb news. Pakistan seems to be taking a very positive role in Afghanistan cricket. I know the Afghanistan under-19 team are also going to be touring Pakistan soon as well. And, very positive. And perhaps Afghanistan as well can return international cricket to Pakistan, hopefully, in the future. Afghanistan would have less issues of playing in Pakistan than most of the full members would. And so that would be a positive for Pakistan cricket in the future. And, the more matches Afghanistan and Ireland and the other associates get against full members, the better.
Moving off from news, we've got some previews to do. I'll leave our big preview for a second to mention a smaller tournament that's, again, though very positive, that Qatar is hosting an international women's cricket championship. I think it started yesterday between Pakistan, South Africa and Ireland, which is excellent.
I had no idea Qatar even had ground with a turf wicket, so shows how much I know. Ireland played Pakistan in an ODI yesterday to start this one. Bowled well to keep Pakistan to 183 for 9. Top scorer wides, as it so often is in women's cricket. And then, unfortunately, the batting wasn't too good. The match was a day-nighter, and I can't imagine Ireland's women have ever played under lights before, and they were bowled out for 73, so lost quite heavily in the end. And they'll play South Africa as well in this tournament, and then they'll play a 2020 tri-series as well at the same venue, and good for Ireland as they prepare for the World 2020 this year.
Yeah, it's an interesting tournament. All three teams are in the same group at the World 2020, so they'll have well practiced against each other. Ireland obviously played Pakistan a number of times over the Irish summer.
Rivalry there. It goes back quite well. Ireland women beat Pakistan in their only women's test match. So obviously it goes back a rivalry that goes back a while. No test cricket for Ireland's women these days, but there isn't much women's test cricket at all, so it seems to be sticking mostly to one day and 2020 matches. The more Ireland play, as with the men's side, the more Ireland play against the full members, the better they're going to get.
Finally, we should go on to the World Cup qualifiers. It's in New Zealand, 10 teams involved. Talk briefly about the format. There's two groups of five. And then a Super 6 where the teams in the Super 6 play the teams that they didn't play in the group already, so that they're in the other group, which effectively means it's essentially a 10-team league that has a cut-off after the first four games. So the best two teams in this league will be the teams that go through. There's two places on offer. It's still the biggest tournament in cricket, the World Cup.
The format is okay. I don't think it's as good as the format that we had for the World 2020 qualifier. But when you're only trying to qualify two teams, you perhaps don't want a sort of knockout semi-final where your one team can have a bad day and then not qualify. You want to be able to have two teams qualify from a league when there's this much at stake. So the format's okay. Not as good as the World 2020 format, but better than formats that we've had for some tournaments.
Traditionally, World Cup qualifiers are pretty close. I think the last one, there was only one win between second and sixth in the table, which means that anything we say about who we think is going to qualify should be taken with a certain amount of grain of salt. But we'll go through them anyway. Starting with Group A, I guess, based on their performance in the World Cricket League, UAE will be very hopeful that they can qualify.
And we'll certainly rely on Shaiman Anwar, who had a great year in 2013. Hopefully he can continue that form. Obviously pushed for automatic qualification. You'd expect them to sort of push Scotland and Nepal quite close, and they're a good side. They do have a spin-heavy bowling attack, though, which sometimes isn't all that useful in New Zealand, so that's where they could come unstuck.
I guess, for me, the favourite in this to top this group, and probably one of the teams I'd expect to go through, would be Scotland. They had a pretty bad World 2020 qualifier, but their warm-ups here have been quite good, and I think New Zealand conditions would suit them better.
Yeah, I think you're right there. They've had a change in coaching as well. Obviously, Peter Stendall has apparently resigned. I think it's a case of jumping before he was pushed, but he's gone now. Now Paul Collingwood and Craig Wright are in charge, and perhaps they can just give Scotland the kick up the backside that they needed after that tournament, and get them to perform much better in this tournament, and perhaps get through to the World Cup.
Another team that needed a bit of a kick was Canada. New coach as well, Andy Pick's taken over. They've lost Ashish Bagai. They seem to be running okay in the first couple of warm-ups, and I'm slightly more positive about them in this tournament because I think they've got a reasonable batting depth that maybe it wasn't as evident in the 2020s, but they're still going to maybe struggle.
Yeah, and they also don't have Rizwan Chima for this tournament, despite the ICC media guide naming as Canada's player to watch for the tournament. He was never named in the squad. But Rizwan Chima hasn't been batting at all well for the last sort of 5 years, really, since he sort of came onto the scene. He then probably started playing not too good. He's become more a bowler in recent years. Obviously not in the team now. Losing Ashish Bagai is a big blow to Canada, and they could struggle even to make the Super Six.
Yeah, I think the team most likely to top them for the Super Six, you guess, would be Nepal.
Yeah, Nepal, they played very well in that World 2020 qualifier. Again, like the UAE, perhaps not got a bowling attack best suited to New Zealand conditions. But I think they've brought in a couple of pace bowlers who didn't play in the UAE, and they're sort of quite hopeful. They've played reasonably well in the warm-up games. And they could well push for a World Cup place. That game between Nepal and Scotland in a week's time will be a very crucial game. That could well end up deciding even who gets to the World Cup in the long run.
Yeah, with Nepal, I still have a few question marks, I think, over their batting depth at a 50-over level. Paras Kakkar seems to be carrying some sort of injury as well, which might really impact on them.
Yeah, that would be a big blow if he can't play at his best. There's been the tendency in the past that if he gets out, the rest of the team follow. We've seen them do a little bit better with their batting recently, so hopefully they can recover from the potential loss of him if he's not playing at his best.
And failing Group A is quite a strong group, given that most of the teams made the World 2020 qualifiers, and the final team is Hong Kong. Again, they're a team I think is much better suited to 2020 cricket.
Yeah, I'd certainly agree with that. They've got some decent players who will play well in one-day cricket, Jamie Atkinson obviously being one of them. But I think they're going to struggle in this tournament, and I don't see them doing as well as they did in the World 2020 qualifier.
Yeah, interesting to see how Mark Chapman goes, though, as he's based in New Zealand and will be more familiar with conditions, so he might end up being a really crucial player for them.
He didn't have too much of a good tournament in the World 2020, but perhaps playing in conditions he's more used to in New Zealand will help him kick on and have a decent tournament.
Yeah, it's moving across to Group B, probably the team that might end up being the favourites for this to win everything here is the Netherlands.
Although they've had a bit of a scare in the warm-up games. They'd lost to the UAE today, lost to Canada in the first warm-up game, so a little bit of a scare, but I think they're by a long way the best team in Group B. They've been playing teams from Group A in the in the warm-up games, so I'd expect them to play very well. Again, you're missing some of their best players, the likes of, you know, we all know Ryan Tenderscott, Tim van der Gooten, etc., etc. But that did seem to stop them in the World 2020 qualifier, and I don't see any reason why it would stop them here. I think the Netherlands are pretty certain to qualify for the World Cup.
And the second best team in this group is actually maybe a bit of a mystery. There's a lot of opportunities for everyone to go through. I guess Kenya would probably be the favourites very slightly.
Slightly. Although they obviously didn't play particularly well in the World 2020 qualifier, they've had a change of coaching as well. We'll see what can. See what will happen for them. Steve Ticklow again playing in this tournament, which you have to think will be his, unless Kenya make that World Cup next year, you have to think this will be Steve Ticklow's sort of last hurrah, and he probably deserves a good end, but I can't see him getting a good end to his career.
It'd be very interesting to see how it goes as well. I think in some ways 2020 cricket's a little bit easier for someone who's perhaps only able to, not as fit as he might have used to be. So the longer days could be interesting for both him and Adoyo.
We said before the World 2020 that we didn't think those two players would do well. We were proven wrong to some extent, especially by Ticklow. And whether they'll perform well in this year, 50 over cricket is more of a young man's game than a 20 over cricket is to some extent, so I hope Ticklow does well, I hope Kenya do well as well, and that they can recover from that terrible performance in the World 2025, but I just don't see it happening, unfortunately.
Well, go by rankings, but I'm not sure that this team is particularly strong, which is Namibia. They do have Jerry Simon back though, which is good news for them.
Yeah, great news for Namibia having Jerry Stein back. Obviously, he's come to some sort of agreement with the Namibian Cricket Board. He's a dangerous player, but he hasn't been playing at international level for a while now. He scored 73 against Scotland in a warm-up game today, so he obviously got back into the groove there. And if he can play well, Namibia will play well, and Namibia will have a chance at progressing, certainly to the Super Six. I don't think they can qualify for the World Cup, though. Having Jerry Simon back is a huge boost for them.
Team we're big fan of here, PNG. How do you think they're going to go?
As we said, it's hard to try and pick the second best team in the group because they're all sort of quite equal. PNG again have Geraint Jones, who'll bring that level of experience. He's probably played more 50-over cricket recently than most of Papua New Guinea boys. As we said earlier, they've not played a 50-over international in 3 years. They have played some 50-over cricket, obviously, in the South Australian Premier League, but not at an international level. So that could count against them. They will need to get rid of that 2020 mindset they've been in for the last few years. I can see them getting to the Super Six. I can even see them, assuming that the top four of this do get ODI status, getting ODI status, but I don't see them qualifying for the World Cup.
Yeah, I think it certainly had the talent to push for that World Cup spot, and certainly the ODI status spot, but that the amount of 2020 cricket they played, and the fact that when they play one-day cricket, when they played in the South Australian Premier League, they have tended to collapse and struggle a little bit to make that adjustment. It makes me dubious of their ability to put on the big scores that their teams probably are going to need to progress here.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that.
And finally, a team that had a really bad World 2020 qualifier, and they might be better suited to the 50-over format, Uganda.
So prior to the World 2020, I'd have said that Uganda had a chance at pushing for a World not for necessarily for a World Cup spot, but for an ODI status spot, assuming four teams get it, rather. But after their performance in the World 2020 qualifier, I'm less confident. I think they probably are the weakest team in the tournament. And it's a shame because had this tournament taken place maybe a year ago, you would have bet on Uganda to do quite well. But now they seem to have declined a little. Maybe, as you say, better suited to 50-over cricket, but it's not looking too good for them.
I'll get some predictions from you, Andrew. I won't ask for group predictions. I'll just ask who you think will qualify. Personally, I'm going to say Scotland and Netherlands. You?
Yeah, I'm going to take those two teams as well. And if anybody's going to upset that lineup, it would be Nepal qualifying maybe ahead of Scotland.
Yeah. My smoke is the UAE. I think they've just played so well in the past year. They seem to be on that kind of roll that maybe might allow them to push forward. I think both Scotland and Netherlands are definitely vulnerable to an upset loss, and an upset loss will be all it will take for a team to maybe miss the World Cup. So it should be a really interesting tournament. I'll be in Christchurch for the last week, so if anyone's listening and wants to come say hello, I'll be around. Just tweet me at Idle Summers, and I'll come and find you. And that's all our show today. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks, Russ.